Torkey loves to work. That's what he's discovered about himself during the global pandemic. He's completed one new recording. It's called Being, and he has a second one all composed and ready to go. And what he's really excited about is embracing a style of music he's unfamiliar with. He did that last year with bluegrass, and this year it's EDM. That's right, electronic dance music. It's something that just kind of feels good. And he figured out a way to do it with acoustic instruments. You're going to hear more about that on this edition of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher. All right, I'm talking with Michael Torkey, who has a brand new recording out called Being. Michael, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I want to start off by just asking you, how are you?
Oh, well, I think under the circumstances, pretty well. I feel kind of a low-grade stress through the past 5 months. And the antidote to that is, as Chekhov says, well, we have to work. So when I work hard, I feel good. And I've been really productive, knock on wood.
So I'm curious what you might have discovered about yourself during this pandemic and everything else that's been going on. What did you discover about yourself that maybe surprised you?
Well, I'm thinking about my dentist, where when I got my teeth cleaned, he said, "Never again. I love work." Imagine a dentist saying that he loves work. He just couldn't wait to get back into the office. It's the most wonderful dental office I've ever been into my life. I love going there just because he's filled with joy. And I guess I could kind of reflect that enthusiasm. I've always known that I like to work, but it really becomes it's the source of one's joy and one's identity. So as long as I continue writing music, then it's sort of, you feel not indestructible, but you just feel alive. I kind of knew that, but it was reinforced.
What have you been working on? What have you really been diving yourself into? I mean, we have this new recording we're going to talk about. Maybe that's it, but maybe there's something else you're also working on that you'd like to talk about.
The 3 months leading up, we found a way to mix this remotely. So my producer, Silas Brown, great producer, great set of ears. He was able to run his board with high fidelity through the internet. I mean, that sounds like anyone should do that, but people send wave files through, but they don't send their entire mixing board through. So we would work two or three times a week for almost 2 months mixing and editing the recording Being, which just came out. Alongside that, given that all the best musicians in New York are on furlough, the Met musicians, the New York Philharmonic, because I have an entire second album that is all composed and ready, it's called Psalms, Lamentations, and Canticles, that uses some of these same musical ideas but adds voice. Silas said, "Oh, we have to strike while the iron is hot. The best players are just itching to work. Call up so-and-so, call up so-and-so. The principal, you know, trombonist of the New York Philharmonic, Joe Alessi." And I wrote him an email, and he was delighted. So it's kind of an embarrassment of riches to be able to record this way in COVID when so many of us are out of work.
And so how are you making that happen when we all can't be in the same place?
Yeah. Well, that's the challenge. Silas will send his high-quality mics over to the people with home studios and tells them what to do, and then we give them some playback tracks and a click track, and then we cross our fingers. But when you're dealing with the best musicians, they can hear something and sense. I mean, I need to coach them before they start. Like Tessa Lark, who was in last year's Sky, which we talked about, she agreed to do three of the string parts on the new album. She did violin one, violin two, and viola. I didn't know she played viola until she told me. So I kind of conferenced with her, and I said, "Here's the general style, and go to the head of the beat, or lay behind here, and amplify everything, because when you're at home, you need to exaggerate dynamics and musical things." And she said, "Got it." And she did it and played flawlessly. So when you're dealing with the best musicians, they can sense what you need.
The last time you and I talked, it was about Sky, and that was about a year ago. And at that time, you said that you're getting to that age where you have dreams of things you want to do, and you don't want to wait around for a commission to be able to do it. And that led to that cool bluegrass recording. Now, the next recording, your new one, is called Being. I also love how you're sticking with your one-word titles that you like. So what led you to this recording?
Yes, it was the same principle of embracing a style of music that I'm unfamiliar with. Last year, it was bluegrass. And this year, it's a branch of EDM, electronic dance music called melodic progressive. Knew nothing about it, studied it, and then tried to absorb it, imposing my own structural and stylistic concerns on it. And I kind of came away with both of those experiences, thinking that it's in the misunderstanding of the form that I'm studying where, the art happens, the magic happens, or some kind of weird unintended result happens. Because I think we discussed about how your husband is an expert at EDM. I'm sure when he listened to it, he said, this has nothing to do with house music. And I would concur. I misunderstand these things, but it sparks something, kind of like dusting the cobwebs away of the imagination. And through that misunderstanding, something else happens. Once had a professor who told me that Tchaikovsky's greatest dream was to write Germanic music. And he really was trying to imitate Beethoven and Mozart, and he kept getting it wrong. And his music ended up sounding more Russian than even the people like Mussorgsky, who we think of as just Ur-Russian, and that somehow Tchaikovsky is the cosmopolitan one. But I think even Stravinsky said that Tchaikovsky was actually in his soul, the most Russian of all of those romantic composers.
So I will challenge you on what you just said about people who are into EDM not liking this. So when I opened this new recording and I put it on the CD player right away, my husband, who loves electronic dance music, loves this recording. And I think that's has a lot to do with the rhythmic element. And I think you got that right. So tell me a little bit more about how you approach this, which became your own style.
The challenge was, could you write a 43-minute piece of music all in one tempo? Which, in a way, now that I say that, when I started off in the 80s, my challenge was, could I write a piece of music for orchestra that stayed in all in one key? This idea of imposing limitations can be very interesting. And if you did that, how would you sustain interest? So that was the basic challenge. In fact, when you look at the CD, there are 9 tracks, because I call it 9 parts, but it's a seamless experience. And I had even thought about releasing it as all one track, so it would force the listener to have to go from beginning to end if they were ever going to embrace that. And I thought, well, maybe that was too much. It might be nice to give the track IDs, which I ended up doing.
Tell me a little bit more about the American Modern Ensemble. Is this a group that you created for this project, or are they a group that exists?
They're a group that has existed for 20, 25 years. A composer friend of mine, Rob Patterson, we were having a bourbon in New York, and I was telling him how I was going to hire some of my friends in Liverpool from the 1010 Ensemble, the Liverpool Philharmonic. And in fact, we budgeted it all out. And he said, why didn't you come to us? This is what we do. A lot of our players are quick readers. They have gigs when they're not doing classical music, playing in Broadway pits. So they can bring together the kind of more popular styles, let's say, with the classical styles. They have great rhythm. And I said, that's what I'm looking for. And we had 4 recording sessions last fall.
Were you part of those recording sessions?
I was the conductor. Yeah, I was the music director, leading them through and trying to inspire them as best I could.
But the whole thing wasn't completed in the fall. Is that right, or was it?
No, we did our, as they call it, tracking. We put down all the tracks in those four sessions. And then time passed. And then starting in May, June, and July, Silas and I mixed and edited everything.
Gotcha. It's amazing how much can be done when you're all in different places, isn't it?
Especially in these days, yeah.
How are people using this music?
Well, I don't know yet. It's been out now, at least digitally. It's been out for 2 weeks. When I studied melodic progressive, what I saw with the comments online, I would go to YouTube and hear these mixes that would last for 2 hours. I got the feeling that, you know, this is your 14-year-old son who's socially ill at ease with himself, pimples on his face, doing his homework. That kind of image of using music as kind of background to other activities, of course, seems counterintuitive for a classical composer to say that when we want to throttle and get the listener's attention front and center. I like the idea of music having a kind of use value over and above or beside any kind of artistic claims it might think it has.
Tell me about the title. Where did the title Being come from?
Yeah, that's one of those things that 30, 40, 50 years ago, program notes were more important than the piece itself when you would go to new music concerts. And I rebelled against that even as a student at Eastman. And now with this, I had a one sentence sleeve note on the album saying what the tempo was and that it was continuous. So what I left out was, I feel that this music is meant to bring some kind of lifting of the spirit. I don't know if it does. That was the goal. And in a sense that philosophy can kind of lift us out of certain darker areas of our life, namely the 20th century dominant philosophy, existentialism. I was thinking that there might be, I mean, that's very pretentious to say that, and one can never make claims of what music does. It's even hard to say whether it's as I said before, a wallpaper or a muzak. That's maybe too much for a composer to say. However, I thought that if it does lift our spirits, in the way that my idea of existentialism gives meaning to my life, I thought about the two most important pieces in the literature in 20th century, Heidegger's Being in Time and Sartre's Being in Nothingness. And if you contract those two titles, you get Being. So that was going to be my inside joke, but I've shared it with your listeners.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around how you got the idea to even do anything based on electronic dance music. Is it because you live in Las Vegas, so you hear it a lot? Or, yeah. You know what I'm saying? What drew you to even want to use that as kind of a template for this?
Well, maybe there's two reasons. One is that I think that I start with rhythm in my music, and that, as it's developed, as house music has developed over the decades, the sense of groove and beats is first and foremost in the music world. So I was kind of coming to the altar with hat in hand of how to up the game with my rhythmic understanding of music. There was that aspect. And then there's something else, and it's kind of the way I think about what music can do. If you think about it, that acoustic instruments have always imitated nature. So a flute, for example, is like a bird song, and a violin is almost like human voice. So music developed with acoustic instruments. Then about 50, 60, 70 years ago, electronic instruments came on the scene. And if you remember, there was great fear in especially classical musicians saying, we are going to be replaced by sampled sound, by electronics. And in a sense, what the electronic movement was doing was coming up with new sounds, But it still was imitating nature, and by and large, it was trying to imitate the acoustic sounds, because the waveform of an oboe is very complex. The sine wave of a synthesizer sound is very simple, and simple waveforms tires the ear very quickly. So the electronic guys were trying to make their sounds more and more complex, imitating live instruments. And so then I thought, well, what if I took live instruments and imitated, once again, the electronic instruments? So then I've come full circle, 360 degrees back around. But it's like the game of telephone. Each time you translate into a new form, you lose something and you gain something, and it changes. It is through those weird translations of one form to the other that some kind of, dare I say it, contribution to art could possibly happen. That's what I think is conceptually interesting about the exercise.
This is a continuous work. It's almost 43 minutes long. You've divided it into 9 parts, however. Why did you do that?
I think each of those parts has its own harmony. Its own melodic profile. Basic groove. And so it's like those mixes that you hear online where, and in the tradition, I guess, of house music, a DJ would spin the records and seamlessly go from one song into the next, and I just love that. And so I thought, well, I would have these 9 moments, but you would almost, well, in some cases you do know, but in some cases you don't. You're all of a sudden into the next part, and in such a seamless way that you don't even know you're there. So in that sense, it feels like a kind of one thrust from beginning to end.
Fans who have followed your music for many, many years are saying, hey, this kind of sounds like music that Michael Torkey was writing in the 80s. And I know there's one piece they refer to called Adjustable Wrench. Is there other music that you've kind of dabbled in that this has sort of evolved out of?
Well, yes and no. I mean, that certainly wasn't the intention, and I was delighted when I heard that some listeners were hearing that, because then it would seem almost like, as I get into my old age, that I'm making references to, like, the whole arc of the catalog of works. That was kind of satisfying. But when I was a student at Yale, I wrote a piece called Yellow Pages. And I remember that at the time I heard this Chaka Khan song and it had this bass line. And I thought, oh, I'm going to transcribe that and I'm going to change the notes and change the harmony and change the instruments, give it to a cello and the left hand of a piano. And when it goes through that kind of function machine, it comes out on the other end being so unrecognizable to anything. I mean, why do I even say that in the program note? Chaka Khan, my music has nothing to do with all of her great achievements. But that was the starting point. And I realized that all the way through, and especially in the 80s, I was trying to do that translation of one form into another to hopefully give energy to the classical tradition.
In a note to me, you mentioned that in an eerie way, this project almost foreshadowed COVID. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Well, sort of like what I had talked about on the second album that Silas and I are now recording, in the way that we could, the music strikes itself to record in isolation. That is possible, given that the beat is so steady, and that our approach with being was also to put everyone on their own track. And so in that sense, it anticipated the limitations of the time that we live.
I do want to just have you go maybe a little bit deeper into what you were hoping people would get from this, and that is that the music is uplifting and hopeful. Can you talk a little bit more about that and why that's important?
Yeah. There's two traditions of musical expression, I would say. One is the listener enters a cathedral and looks up, and the other is that you hang all your dirty laundry on the clothesline. Well, what I mean by that is one tradition of being creative is to bring out your personal feelings about things. And especially when we're in trying times, or like when 9/11 happened, or when the Second World War happened, a lot of artists felt it was their responsibility to reflect that darkness and that rage. And some people did it very well, like Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time is a perfect example of that. High art, speaking to the age. The other idea is when I'm in my car trying to get out of the house during COVID and I'm driving into the desert and I put on Bach and I suddenly feel better. It's like I took medicine. I still don't understand why Bach has the magic. He uses the same seven notes as the rest of us, the diatonic scale, and his music makes me happy. A lot of other music doesn't. And I've always admired that. And I thought, could I write some music that would just lift the spirit? And in times of stress, worry, and darkness, maybe that would be a kind of a medicine, a mild medicine. Again, I can't make any claims, but to the extent that Bach, you know, can lift the spirit, that is the faraway goal that I'm aiming.
Losing yourself in some uplifting music on a new recording called Being with Michael Torkey. That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. If you're enjoying New Classical Tracks, the best thing that you can do for the show is to tell somebody else about it, help spread the word, and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. Thanks to Valerie Kaler, the producer of this podcast, New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher.